Hello and welcome. It's another podcast from your friends at Books of the Year. It's the Books of the Year podcast, the one you've been waiting for. So, an email from Adele Cook. First up, dear Simon and Matt, I just finished listening to your interview with Anthony Horowitz, who is one of my favourite authors. I'm exhausted. I have had the pleasure of being in the audience for a couple of his book tours. Wow, can he pack in the content?
Yes,
and that's
he can.
Just like in a sentence.
Yeah.
Do you think on a words per minute basis, he's one of the best value podcast interviewees? I think you're probably right. Adele, I think he speaks so fast. Probably he has more stuff going on in the sentence than anyone else.
He's got loads.
And Adele says, P.S. Always finish your book, start a series of book one, and I order my bookshelves by author.
Good for you, Adele. Might not agree on all of those, but good for you anyway. An email from Ben. Dear Bookends, I'm a big sports fan and really love reading books about sport. I don't just mean non-fiction, but novels too. However, they're actually quite hard to come by, and I wondered if you could help me. Ages ago, when you were on the old network, you featured a book about two Olympic cyclists. I remember you discussing it at the time, and I thought it sounded good, but didn't read it then, and now have no idea what it is. Can you help at all? Thanks, Ben. The book, Ben, is Gold by Chris Cleave, which I have a vague memory of. I have to say, it was vague. Yeah,
but it was a good book and we both enjoyed it, I think.
Yes.
But that's definitely the book that you're after, Cleave with an E at the end. You can email us at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky, at Books of the Year. Now, we have one of the great screenwriters and authors in the UK, Broadchurch creator, the third showrunner of Doctor Who. He did Torchwood. He wrote on Life on Mars, Born and Bred, A Law and Order UK, and Agatha Christie's Seven Dials. And now, Chris Chibnall has a brand new book for you. Yes, and our special guest is Chris Chibnall, whose new book is called The Parkwood Murders. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
We're okay. We're speaking the day after England's match against Mexico. I didn't stay up. What did you do?
I did the 7 a.m. BBC Two replay. Thanks, BBC Two, with no spoilers.
It's quite good. As someone who knows his drama on television, that's pretty good programming, don't you think?
Really good. Destination programming as live, and also a match that had everything, didn't it? Just in terms of all of those plot points.
I know this is irrelevant and when you're not here to talk about this, but as a dramatist, do you think you see drama in sport in the way that a more casual observer would not?
Yes, I think you're always looking at the storylines, the bones of matches, the stories of matches, the character arcs. The match last night being the perfect example. Jordan Henderson booked and injured without coming on, but there, as we were just talking just before about the vibes, he's there for that. And then Jarrell Kwanzaa and the right back storyline. And so, everything's plotted in football. And I love it, but it's uncontrollable as well. So I'm a Liverpool season ticket holder, and it's like that thing. It's one of the few things I can do around events and narrative where that sense of not being able to control it or analyse it or know what's coming is really thrilling.
Oh, right. I thought you might think it was quite frustrating because you like to control the story. That's what you do.
No, I like to go somewhere I don't know. I can't see what's coming. And also, yell at people.
Yes.
So
it's two Liverpool supporters.
Finally.
Come on, there you go.
Finally.
All right. So, Matt, describe the cover here. What are we looking at?
So we are deep in a forest and it feels like dusk, but it might be dawn. But there's some light coming up, but there's some mist as well. But dominating the centre of the picture, apart from the trees in the middle of this forest, are two lodges. One of those lodges shrouded in darkness. The other lodge has a light on. And in big white letters across the centre of the book, the Parkwood Murders. They came for an escape, but can they escape a killer? And at the top, Chris Chibnall, the Sunday Times bestseller.
Again, just on the visuals, Chris, as someone responsible for many of the finest television that we've seen, do you have strong opinions about the way your books look?
Yes, but I've been really lucky with both books that they've sent me the cover going, what do you think of this? And they've both been brilliant. And I think that, in fact, three covers, because the paperback and the hardback of Death at the White Hart, which preceded this, were two different images. But yeah, I think, but it's a real art form, the cover and the cover design, mm-hmm. because how you are summing up and teasing a book without spoiling it, but also giving an atmosphere of it. I think the cover of Parkwood Murders does that really well. It's moody and it's interesting and it's
it has a little bit of that Cabin in the Woods thing, like you don't want to stay there. Although yeah. you can see why people would, because it's quite smart and high end, except the way it's lit suggests bad things happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think your description of it and your evocation of it there, Simon, is exactly what I would want you to feel. It's deliberately set in a holiday village that would be familiar to many people who might have been on holiday in villages in the woods with lodges.
We'll just describe. So the Parkwood Holiday Village, there are other Parkwood Holiday Villages, but this is one. Where are we? Just describe what it's like.
It's in West Dorset, and it's a holiday village of a couple of hundred lodges. People from all over the country come there. It's there's a pool complex, there's high ropes, there's a boating lake, and you come there and when you visit this place, as in so many holiday villages around the country, you leave your car behind in the car park and everything is locked down, and you go to your lodge and you have an idyllic week or weekend in the woods, in nature, incredibly peaceful.
Yeah.
Possibly less so in this book.
Yes. And why would that be?
Well, a security guard in chapter one finds a
That's right.
body.
So we are just talking about chapter one.
Yeah.
Yes.
A security guard in chapter one finds a body in the swimming pool as the wave machine is going at 4 a.m. and somebody has been murdered and left in the pool. And Detective Nicola Bridge and her detective partner Harry, known as Westlife for his boy band Good Looks, investigate. But it's basically one big locked room mystery, with the locked room being an entire holiday village of 400 suspects, and then all the staff and the people who work there, and the guests are all going to check out on Friday. So it's a locked room mystery, race against time, with many twists and turns, I hope.
So you mentioned locked room there, and that's what jumped to my mind as well when I was reading this, because as you say, everyone's left everything behind as they enter this park. You can't get in or out without going through security. So it is a bit like having this sort of isolated country house where there's no way in or out, and there's been a murder, so it must have been somebody who's in the house. And I thought, I can't believe no one's thought of this before, because these holiday villages where we're skating around, not saying the brand name, the holiday village we all know of.
Many holiday villages are available.
There are many other good, not just that one. But I can't believe no one's thought of that before. But this idea, but it's still, it's a great idea.
I'm thrilled you said that, because I've sort of sat on this idea for about 7 years.
Wow.
and just about trying to get around to writing it. Because it is, and the way it's always sat in my head is exactly as you've described it. Yes, a locked room mystery, but a modern day country house murder mystery where it's like, okay, what is the equivalent for all of us now? We go to these places which are luxurious, which are sort of like where we live, except they're just transplanted to the forest. But we're all guests and there are staff and those dynamics, those relationships. Yeah, it was exactly that. So I'm thrilled you picked up on that.
So here's, I've never been on one of those holidays, but I know that there are loads of people who are massive fans of them. They go every year. But I was intrigued by what, and I think I've picked up on something in the book where I think I know how you feel about them. And I'm just going to read slightly here.
Author's note.
Parkwood was sold as a holiday experience in nature, where nature was strictly controlled. The countryside without the dirty, smelly, bumpy, or dangerous bits. And even though there you're not saying anything negative, it felt to me like you're saying, this is not for me. I rather like the bumpy, dangerous, smelly bits.
Well, I've been to some of these holiday villages and had some great holidays there with my kids when they were younger. But it's also, it's A, vastly expensive, and B, just weird. It's got that slightly uncanny valley version of a holiday, and it's also it's curated, so it's ironed out, and even those holidays have evolved over a period of time and is much more commercial now. So it's supposed to be a smooth and frictionless version of the countryside, and I don't think any of us buy that. But they're also amazing, and if you've got 3 and 5 year old kids, and you know there's childcare and sandpits and nurseries and all of them, ball pools and all that kind of stuff. So what's always interesting is when you've got a setting or a group of characters where you can feel sort of both sides of the argument of like, this is a great thing, it's a terrible thing, everybody's going there, but then everybody's shut in, that's a bit mad, you know, and we all agree by the rules of this holiday village for 5 days. And it also just feels like a great way. It's like a microcosm of the country as well, which is also what appealed to me in writing it.
In what way?
Well, because all life is here, you know, all different classes, all different demographics, ages, people from different parts of the country. And then you've also got the upstairs, downstairs element of the people who work there and what their attitude is to the place, as well as the people who stay there. So even some of the people who stay there and some of the characters in the novel are ambivalent about why they're there. Some of them love it. Some of them are a bit less bothered. And then there's the staff who are, again, differing ages, have got differing backstories, that really it's like, what is this experience that sort of has rooted in our culture? I mean, I guess, 50, 60 years ago, it would have been more Butlins and Pontins, and now it's become a more sort of middle-class, aspirational experience. So
they're pretty chippy, a lot of the people staying there, it seems to me.
Well, they might have reason to kill you, see, Simon. That's the reason.
At your writing desk, did you have a map of this entire village? I think we're told it's 250 acres.
Yeah.
And who is living in which lodge? Because that's a lot of lodges, a lot of people, a lot of suspects.
Yeah, it's part of the delight of plotting it is to map out where are the different areas, who's where at what point, who's in which lodge and which area and which part of the park, and where. And obviously there are big things in the novel which are part of the infrastructure of the park or disrupted elements of how the park was built. So everything becomes the setting becomes also a great fertile ground for clues or red herrings and that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Tell us about the coppers then. You've mentioned who they are. They turn up in your book, Death at the White Hart.
Yes.
This is where we meet them for the first time. Get us up to speed. What do we need to know about them?
So the main detective is Nicola Bridge. She is 40 years old. She, in Death at the White Hart, she comes back to her hometown of Briddy in West Dorset after a couple of decades away in Liverpool. She came back to sort out her personal life and to address her work-life balance, failed to address her work-life balance because there was a body on the A35 with deer antlers tied to a chair. She solved that crime, met this new partner professionally, Harry Ward. And so we meet them in this novel a year later, and they are coming from a very under-resourced police organisation, Three Counties Police, which is sort of emerged all of the southwest counties, underfunded, no HQ, no staff. So they have to deal with this murder in a very stretched financial and logistical situation.
Yeah, that sounds to me as though you may have contacted a few coppers known to you, who have said nothing other than we are underfunded, we don't have enough resources, and we're pretty annoyed about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference, see, when I wrote Broadchurch for TV, it's sort of, which is 2012, 2013, the first series, and it's interesting looking back, going, it's a given that the police forces are funded and have headquarters and enough office space and enough staff. And then now when we're looking at any police story, and talking to those guys who work there, it is very much, we don't have the resources, we don't have the place, and that's terrible for society and great as an author, because it just, what it means is your characters are really tested, really stretched, and have to you can go much deeper into them because they're called on to show their resourcefulness.
So these, as you say, these detectives have turned up at Parkwood, and they're investigating the murder of this guy who's turned up dead in the wave pool. But it very quickly comes out that another person has disappeared.
Yep.
That a woman disappeared in the sort of the way it's described in the book is in the sort of months after lockdown has finished. So in other words, COVID has happened. Then we've had the lockdowns, and as anyone listening to this podcast will remember, those there were waves of different lockdowns. Yep. But this in the sort of when one of those lockdowns has lifted, everyone obviously wants to go on holiday, that kind of thing, and. In the process of describing that, it just reminded, and we've had other authors come on who've described or set their book in the events just after lockdown, during lockdown, that kind of thing. But I thought for the first time when I was reading your book how this has left a scar on all of us that we don't really like talking about, because there is a scar on all of us. Obviously, people will have physically suffered from this, will have lost close members of their family through this. But even for those who didn't, this has left a scar. And I felt that more from your book than I think I've done with any other. Just talk to us a little about what you were trying to achieve.
Yeah, thank you for picking up on it. I really loved the way you talk about that there, because it's it was exactly that. It's like, how do you write about something? I mean, anytime you're writing a novel and you're writing about characters and they're emotional psychology and what has happened to them before we meet them in the novel, you're just thinking, well, what are the events of the last 5 years, the events of the last 10 years? And you're right, a lot of times we haven't written about it much or had much about it because we all lived through it.
Yeah.
and that was enough. And what I wanted to write about was just that long tail, that it's in us now, but it's the sort of, like you say, the sort of immediate physical scars, the immediate physical traumas, or for people who've lost people, that's now a moment of past history and a solid event. But actually the ripples and the echoes,
yeah,
and what it's done to people, I we are only now starting to discover, and in real time.
So I suppose my question there would be, was that something that you decided to include when you were writing, or was it something that was in your head right at the beginning? Is this is something I want to address? How COVID has left this scar on all of us?
I think it's somewhere in between the two, to be honest, because it's something that I had been feeling for a long time, and I wanted to find the right frame for it. And within this, what was interesting is a lot of those holiday resorts and hospitality were some of the first things to open up. And actually thinking about that, and thinking about the difference, that it also can illustrate the difference between the period immediately when that was happening and what it's like today. Because also I think we've forgotten really quickly and sort of blanked it out, and going, what was it like in those months where you could go on holiday, but you couldn't go near people and you couldn't, you know, so all of that sort of stuff. But mainly, what did it do to us emotionally, and who were we then and who are we now, and those sorts of things. But to also write about that in a very, that it doesn't disrupt the dynamism and the page-turning nature that it's become. I suppose what I'm always looking for as I'm writing is something that has a real hook and a real pace and a real propulsion, but within it you can be addressing those kind of interesting, churning psychological issues and complexity while also having big cliffhangers. And keeping you reading. So it felt like there was a lot to delve into, and again, it's another thing, I think, particularly in murder mysteries and the ones I write, I've tried to make them psychologically true and real and have emotional credibility, but it's, you're looking for everybody having things that they're dealing with that really ripple out, that aren't just sort of kept inside, that that we're all dealing with.
I have bored people for a long time about COVID and writing and stories and mentioned a few times that in the same way that we find stories still about the First World War and the Second World War still being told, COVID, which affected literally everybody listening to this podcast, and everyone in the world will have a COVID story, yeah. How it affected them. The storytelling will emerge, yours being one of the first, but, you know, it'll take a while for everyone to tell their story. And I was just listening to what you were saying, that in, so the First World War, Second World War, we know those stories. The thing that killed more people than the First World War was the Spanish flu, the inappropriately named Spanish flu. But anyway, everyone knows what I mean. Yeah. Killed more people. How many books I'm sure there are some. But in popular culture, I don't think there are many books set there.
Yeah, this is exactly it. And I did an adaptation last year, just went on to Netflix beginning of this year, of Agatha Christie, mm-hmm. Seven Dials Mystery. And when we were doing that, I set it, it was originally written in 29, and I reset it in 25 for exactly the reason you were talking about there, Simon, which is the shadow of the First World War affects the 20s, but nobody talks about the Spanish flu. And it's quite important in that show, but nobody's talking about it in that generation. And then you think, but the Roaring 20s is not, I think you can think that's the response to the First World War, but I'm with you. Where is all that fiction? Where is all that drama about the Spanish flu, which really, you know, killed so many people? And I wonder if it's the same with COVID. I wonder if it was a similar thing of like the thing we live through. And it's a different thing, isn't it? It's a different thing to a conflict, which is inherently dramatic and external, and in some ways what we saw with COVID is confusing and it's disparate and it's a lot more passive as well. So I really love that you brought that up, because it's been on my mind, and I think that's another reason it's in the book. And Matt, when you're asking about did you approach it thinking about this or that, it's because of that. I was also working on Seven Dials and thinking about that, and thinking about the absence of Spanish flu cultural artifacts in the 10-20 years afterwards is really interesting.
You know that winter coat that you have, which you only wear when it's really cold? I put one on, obviously, in the winter, and put my hand in the pocket, and out came a mask.
Yes.
And I threw it away because I'm thinking, no, thank you. I don't. But, you know, it's just there. It's just around the corner. It doesn't take much to bring it all back again.
There's that physical echo I was talking about. It's still in all our emotional pockets, and we don't know what's there, and we've forgotten, except we haven't. And then it. Did you have any kind of physical reaction when you pulled that out?
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I had them. Well, I wrote a book called TikTok, which was commissioned before COVID, which happened to be about an outbreak of what becomes a rare form of meningitis. And I think after COVID, no one wanted to read a book about any kind of outbreak of anything, to be honest. So, yes, I think it was a physical reaction, because it has a smell. You remember, you know, going on the tube just down from where we are here. The first thing you do, put your hand in your pocket, put on the mask, and then you look at other people, judge people who aren't wearing the mask, thinking I might change carriage, you know, and all. There's that whole dialogue that's going on.
Yeah.
And that's just a couple of years ago.
That's a really interesting word, judging, as well, because it that suddenly makes me think that sense of judgment that came in COVID, of mask or not mask, vaccination or not vaccination.
Thank heavens in America, we didn't have the politicization of to vax or not to vax or to wear a mask, which is the most ludicrous political divide of all time.
Yeah, but I wonder if that's echoed down into there is a greater sense of judgment amongst people on behavioural ticks now. And I wonder if that's just the tiniest fragment of that, or the shard of that surviving.
Yeah, it's interesting. And certainly it radicalised a lot of people politically, that whole thing about being inside, going online. We've got off topic here, but it's a it's a shadow.
It comes into the book as well, I think, because there's a real sense that as the investigation progresses and the days sort of tick by, or the hours tick by, but there's a sense of the guests all coming together and demanding a public meeting and being very vociferous of like, come on, you know, what are you doing and why aren't you communicating? And that feels like that sort of febrile nature of a of a crowd now, as opposed to, again, a decade ago, is different. So I think it's very much on topic.
I think you're right. I think that dynamic has changed, where people are, no, I'm not putting up with this, and I'm going to very much make myself a nuisance to communicate that. I want to talk. So we've talked about the detectives. There is a character who comes up pretty early in the book, who I immediately identified with. And my instinct is that most people reading this book will feel the same. And that is Alice. And I want you to talk to us about Alice, because she... I found myself looking at the world through her eyes and going, no, absolutely, that is how I find myself as well. Just tell us about who she is and what she's doing at Parkwood.
She's one of the cleaning staff, really. So she's a 19-year-old. She's been working there a short while. She's being mentored by the manager there, and she's the sort of eyes of the innocent abroad in there, really, just going. And she has the sort of perspective on the whole park and all the guests, and that's really her role in it, and that she is without guile in that sense.
Yeah. And it felt deliberate as well. Is, as you say, she is this sort of innocent there, where we are seeing everything through her eyes, and often you need that, don't you? You need that person that's going to be, I'm going to bring the reader in and establish this environment through them. And she felt perfect for that.
Well, I think that's great, and I think it's also... lots of the other people there have experience of the holiday park and have been able to afford to go there. So Nicola and Harry have both been to these sorts of establishments and resorts before and understand how they work. And Alice has a different perspective on it from working there, but also from going, this is an amazing place. You know, she also loves it, and she loves the people there, and she looks up to all that. So she's she has that sort of pure, unadulterated love for it as well, and what it can be, and so.
But she's also overlooked, isn't she? She's sort of, and that's what it felt to me like. The decision to make her a cleaner is sort of, you know, she's very happy in the role of, I'm just going to get, you know, in fact, I think she says at one point, the worst thing is when people wait around and want to be there while I'm cleaning. I just want to get it done and go. But it's that role of being the cleaner, where everyone, you just look straight through them.
Yeah, and it means she can see everything. So you know, as we go through all of these suspects and everything, in a sense, she has the sort of purest point of view, so that she can do that and see what's going on between all of these people, and she knows stuff that other people don't know. You know,
this is a very, very small point, Chris, but I am aware, just reading back over some of the things that I've written, that an awful lot of my characters seem to think and work things out in the shower. And and there's a section where Nicola Bridges is in the shower, and she thinks up all kinds of things. You go, yeah, that's not going to work. Yeah, that's going to work. Okay, that's fine. That was a useful shower. And it seems to me, because I think I do this, which is why I like to, is that you're presumably on your own. And the water is cascading on your head, so you cannot hear anything else. You are not just on your own, but you are orally on your own. And that makes it a perfect place for someone to think.
Yeah, that's not a small point. That's you've zeroed in there, and that's so interesting. That's in your writing as well. But is that because, like, so for me, the confession is, I have so many writing ideas in the shower. I often come out of the shower and I'm like, nobody talk to me. I've just got to write five things down.
I think that's why it's not silent, because you've got cascading water.
Right.
But you've got no one else. There's probably no music. There's no one else talking. It's just you on your own with noise, like white noise almost.
Yes.
And I think that's... And I wonder, actually, given that I know you wrote plays and you wrote TV shows, so you're a master at the screenplay... But what you don't do there is interior monologue.
Exactly. That's been the big difference.
Has this been the joy of writing these novels?
Yeah, it really is going into all of the characters' minds, their interiority. It also means you can change the shape of time within the moment, and that you can have three temporal states existing at one point and in one thought if you're writing the mind of a character in a way you can't really on screen or in theatre, which is both of which much more sort of literal with time. It's been one of the great joys, and then combining that with the whodunit genre, where you can be in multiple points of view in different chapters, and you can so in both Death at the White Hart and the Parkwood Murders, we're in different points of view of people who are potentially suspects as well, and I've loved doing that, and because you go so deep into character, really, don't you? And you really want to excavate them and turn them inside out, and yeah, that's what I've really loved.
So I'm going to take a chance here, Chris, because I'm going to read you something from literally the last page of your book. So there are no, I should say straight away, there are no spoilers in this at all. But it leapt out to me, and I'm going to explain to you why. But basically, you've got a retired detective is talking to one of the current detectives who's investigating this murder. And he says, "It breaks you, this job," said Keith, looking mostly at Harry. "Sooner or later, you don't think it will, but it does." Now, the reason why that jumped out to me is it felt deliberate. Also, the reason it joined. Before we did this interview, I was meeting a friend, and his son has just in the last 6 months joined the police, and he was saying, "I have noticed a change in him, like just in the last few months, of how much that has changed him." And I thought it felt to me not like it sounds like it might be a throwaway line, but it felt to me like it's not a throwaway line, that a detective would say, "I've been doing this long enough. You don't think it's going to affect you or break you, but trust me, I've seen it happen. It's happened to me, and it's happened to everyone else I know who's done this job, and it will happen to you." So I just want you to talk a little bit about that. Was that something you were thinking of? Was that something that you wanted to get across? Or was it just a line you decided to use towards the end?
No, this is like sitting an exam in my own writing and getting therapy here. It's very interesting, all of the lines you're picking out. It's really fascinating. I think I've done a lot of research with police officers and detectives over the years for various projects. And the sense of the cases that you don't quite crack, or that get away from you, or have a resolution that you don't want, or that you know that you haven't delivered on the promise that you make to families or the public. That's the thing that is very interesting, dramatically, character-wise, but also a sort of tragedy from people who are doing this incredible public service. So the duality for these people of all of the successes that they will have had, all of the great work they will have done, and then just that one. And it's a great metaphor for sort of life, isn't it? It's like you don't necessarily hold your triumphs with you all the time. The thing that's nagging at you in your head is that one thing, or that one moment, or those are the things. It's human nature, isn't it? Both professionally and personally. And it's so that's why that's in there. It does speak to that element.
Over the years, you've spoken to hundreds of authors, Chris, and there's a constant discussion as to whether you plan and plot and you get it all sorted, or you just make it up as you go along. And we've had many great writers do both. It's just a personality thing. I would have thought, coming from where you come from, that you can't start, this is my guess, you can't start writing a 6-part drama series for television and not quite know where it's going to end in the way you could do for a novel. That you have to go episode, because you've had to tell the commissioners, "I need 6 parts, we need this cast, we need to end there, we need to do this," so you budgeted in the whole thing. Do you bring that discipline to a novel, or do you enjoy making it up as you go along because you can and you are budget free?
Yeah, well, you're correct about how it works in television. It's a little bit of both. I mean, I think I want to know that I've got characters and I've got a world and a storyline. So a lot of it is, I mean, first of all, a lot of research, and particularly with something like this, researching the world of not just what it's like to go on holiday in one of these villages, what's it like to work there, and the different jobs, what's it like to run it, how does it work? So a lot of research into that. But in terms of planning, I have a load of whiteboards in my office. So I have 3 double-sided kind of 6-foot by 4-foot whiteboards. And I, I scribble up a lot of things. Each whiteboard has a slightly different purpose for, you know, some have characters on, some has the shape of the narrative, or some events that I know are going to be important. It's planned a fair bit, but I subscribe to that David Lynch quote of plan rigorously and allow for happy accidents. Is there's a certain point, and you must know this, that there's a certain point where the material starts to tell you, particularly if it's coming together the way you hope, and the characters start to tell you things you didn't know, and then new characters start to walk in, you think, oh, they've just said something about this other person that I didn't know. So I try and keep it rigorously plotted, mm-hmm. and then also open to it. And when I was doing the Agatha Christie show, I was researching her methods, and she had that sense of, she wrote about, I think, somewhere between 60-80% of her novels, and then would decide on the identity of the killer, having read it back and gone, ah, this is what I hadn't realised when mm-hmm. I was writing it. So, I feel like in this genre particularly, you need to know where you're going, otherwise you're going to be floundering a bit.
This feels like a six-parter for Netflix as well.
Well, we're doing Death at the White Hart for ITV. We're filming that next year.
So. Well, ITV will be fine. ITVX. I'll watch on ITVX. I'll put up with those ads every 5 minutes.
I think it's about $4.99 a month signing to get rid of those.
I'm not paying for anything else.
Okay, yeah.
I think so. Yeah. So part two of this conversation will be with you in a few days when Chris does the Q&A, but for the moment, Chris Chibnall, author of The Parkwood Murders, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.